Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
I'm not going anywhere. In fact, I'm running for mayor.
Former Housing Authority Board Chair Matt Brewer enters the race for mayor just months after Mayor Johnson moved to oust him from the CHA. Some costs for federal food assistance are being shifted to states. How much could Illinois stand to pay? And how a free boxing program on the city's west side is giving young people opportunities. First off tonight, did you feel it? Because some residents on Chicago's North Shore did. We're talking about the 2.9 magnitude earthquake reported by the U.S. Geological Survey this afternoon. The USGS pegged the tremor's epicenter at 13 miles northeast of Evanston, or Lake Michigan, at 2:38 p.m. A quake like that is considered weak, and while it can be felt, it rarely causes damage. The largest quake to hit Illinois in the last 20 years was a 5.2 magnitude quake in 2008 in the southern part of the state. A memorial honoring the survivors of Chicago's history of police brutality is finally in process after 11 years.
For years, people refused to believe us. They questioned our stories, denied our experience. That disbelief caused another kind of pain. But today, our truth is being recognized. Our voices are finally being heard, and that recognition is healing. This memorial is about more than remembering the past. It's about educating future generations, honoring those who survive, and inspiring people to stand up against injustice wherever they see it.
Officials broke ground today on the memorial, which was promised back in 2015 when City Council passed a reparations package for those who survived the torture, torment, and often wrongful convictions under former police commander John Burge and his detectives. Organizers say the memorial in the Washington Park neighborhood will include a timeline of the racially motivated pursuit and torture of mostly young black men starting in the 1970s. It'll also include the decades-long effort of organizing and litigating to expose the practice. The memorial is the last piece of that reparations package, which also included a formal apology, a reparations fund, and free City College's enrollment. Chicago residents will soon have a new top doc if Mayor Brandon Johnson's latest appointment is confirmed. Dr. Garth Walker is currently chief medical officer for Rush Health. He also served as deputy director for the Illinois Department of Public Health during the COVID pandemic, where he expanded vaccination efforts and advanced health initiatives for the opioid epidemic. The appointment now goes to City Council for approval. Who's hungry? A quintessential Chicago pastime is back in Grant Park. The annual Taste of Chicago opened today for a 5-day celebration of food, music, and culture. In previous years, the Taste had been pushed later into the summer or spread out across neighborhoods because of other Grant Park activities like the NASCAR street race. For the first time this year, the new chef's stage will spotlight some Chicago chefs, including Maya Camille Broussard, Diana Davila, and John Mannion. Headliner musical performances include Beach Bunny, Common, and Julieta Venegas. Up next, one-on-one with Chicago candidate for mayor Matt Brewer. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Chicago residents will cast ballots for who they want to be mayor in less than a year. And the pool of candidates is already getting crowded. Lawyer and former Chicago Housing Authority Board Chair Matt Brewer recently threw his hat in the ring, running on a pro-business and affordability-focused campaign. Brewer is a Southside native who co-owns the iconic Wiener Circle and the city's first independent black-owned cannabis dispensary. And he joins us now. Matt Brewer, welcome, and Congrats on running for the big job.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you have a diverse background, as we mentioned. You hold degrees from Stanford, Yale Law, and Harvard Business. You co-own the city's only black-owned cannabis dispensary, as well as Wiener Circle. Of course, there's your experience on the CHA board. How does all of that experience inform the kind of leader you'd like to be?
It's a great question. And right now, Chicago is at a pivotal turning point. The next mayor will step into a seat that no other mayor has stepped into, where we have a fully elected school board for the first time ever, less control over, direct control over transportation with the shifts in the board. We have a fully empowered and independent city council that's passed budgets around instead of with the mayor, and all these agencies like CHA and others who've become a lot more independent as well. Fractured relationships in city council, fractured relationships in Springfield. The next mayor can't step in and put all those genies back in the bottle. We have a new day of governance, a new day of leadership, and we now need a mayor for this particular moment who can wear lots of different hats, speak different languages to different people, to bring everyone together around a shared vision. And everything you just mentioned, lawyer, entrepreneur, small business owner, government, nonprofit, are the hats that I wear that I think prepare me for this new phase of leadership in our city.
You've never held elected office amongst, you know, all of that experience that we just talked about. Why should voters believe that you're prepared to manage, you know, one of the largest city governments in the country?
I announced about 2 weeks ago, and the single thing I heard the most was people excited and energized by someone stepping into this race who doesn't represent politics as usual. And so I view it as an asset rather than a liability. But that said, I did spend the last year of my life running the Housing Authority. It's a $1.4 billion budget, 135,000 residents in our city, and it's very connected to how our city operates in terms of housing, transportation, safety. And so I like to say I come from the outside, but I have knowledge of the inside. And so I'm not walking in trying to figure out how to turn the lights on.
You spent years leading the CHA, as we said. You ended up, of course, having, you know, a fairly public dispute with the mayor this past year. He ultimately demoted you from CHA chair after the board voted to hire Keith Pettigrew as its CEO over the mayor's objections. Setting that aside, though, we hear a lot about housing and housing affordability in the city of Chicago. How can the city ease restrictions, making housing more affordable for people here?
It's a great question. We have an affordability crisis in the city as a whole, and it especially hits home with respect to affordable housing. Housing is at the intersection of everything, as I mentioned. It touches public safety, it touches transportation, it touches on economic mobility, meaning can someone born here have an opportunity to get outside of that pocket and get more access and more opportunity? And so part of the answer to that question is it starts with City Hall. And a vision at City Hall on the fifth floor that coordinates with CHA, that coordinates with DPD, the Department of Housing, that coordinates with public and private partnerships to look at all the land we have in our city. There's an opportunity to increase affordable housing, market rate housing, and a bunch of other community assets. They all have to work together and be done in a way that's considerate of transportation and public safety and all the other factors.
Mayor Johnson has had a strained relationship with Chicago businesses as of late because of his proposed corporate head tax, which the city council rejected. He championed the phase out of the tipped minimum wage, controversial move, because we know there was some back and forth. And you've said that, quote, we can be a city that's affordable to live and a great place to do business. How can Chicago become a more business-friendly city?
In fact, we have to be a city that is both more affordable and friendlier for businesses. The way I talk about it is we have to move Chicago forward without leaving people behind. And on the moving Chicago forward piece, we're talking about growth. We're talking about bringing in new businesses, creating new jobs, jobs for the future, a place where businesses can operate, grow, attract new businesses, a place where people want to live, work, and play, which also requires public safety. But on the not leaving people behind piece, we're talking about education and workforce development and pathways for everyone to participate in this Chicago so that we can all move forward together. And also on this side of not leaving people behind are some of the issues we talked about before, the fundamentals, affordable housing, transportation. We can't leave those out. And so when we create a Chicago that generates more revenue, we can address a lot of the issues that we struggle with in our budget right now, and we rise the tide for everyone. It's not a community or business. The answer is both.
So just yesterday, Mayor Johnson announced that the city is heading into the second half of the year with a $130 million budget shortfall because the revenue that was expected from this budget that he did not approve, he says it has not materialized. Does that mean that city council should have implemented his ideas that we discussed, the corporate head tax, for example?
The $130 million hole that was disclosed yesterday is disappointing. It doubles down on this point that I'm making, that we need a coordinated, serious plan to generate long-term sustainable revenue. Even a lot of the fixes or the sources of revenue that they were expecting for that $130 million were one-time fixes that wouldn't result in long-term sustainable revenue. We need to bring in more businesses, more people, increase our tax base, and by doing that, we generate more revenue over time. We can't tax our way out of it. We can't cut our way out of it with our existing people and businesses. We need to grow.
To that point, you know, how do you attract those businesses, right? How does the city balance its books without alienating businesses?
Mm-hmm. We've seen it done before. We create an environment where businesses can operate. And a lot of this is threading a needle. There's no magic wand that makes it happen immediately, but it starts with partnership. It starts with relationships. It starts with credibility with those communities. You have a round table of people who are all giving the best and brightest ideas, and we implement some of them. Some of them relate to taxes, some of them relate to other incentives, some of them relate to partnerships, and some of them relate to getting creative and thinking outside the box about new revenue streams.
Public safety, of course, it is a big concern for a lot of voters. What would your approach to violent crime and public safety be?
It's important, and it comes at a time where we're anticipating our current superintendent stepping down in less than 2 weeks. Next week. And it's a multifaceted approach. Obviously, prevention, you get the highest return on investment from prevention. Intervention is important, and then enforcement. Partnership and credibility are important. More than just the numbers, we need a place where people feel safe. And you go into South and West Side pockets, people still don't feel safe. You go into the Gold Coast or other neighborhoods on the North Side, people still don't feel safe, regardless of what we see in the numbers. And so we need a world where people feel safe, and we can actually start to address some of the root causes.
Okay, 10 seconds left. You've declined to share your political leaning so far, moderate, progressive, socialist. Why not?
Well, the funny thing is, I am not a politician. I am a person who loves Chicago and a professional. And so I don't fit neatly into the political boxes, and I'm not running to do that. I'm running to improve Chicago. And so if I want to bring people along for the ride, that means I can't love business or want to push businesses forward too. The answer is both.
All right, so skipping the labels for now. Matt Brewer, candidate for mayor, thanks for joining us. Good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Additional candidates running for mayor have been also joining us on Chicago Tonight, with more coming in the weeks ahead. You can visit our website to find those interviews at WTTW.com/mayor2027. Illinois could soon have to spend tens of millions from its own budget to continue serving residents on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The change comes as part of President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which shifts a portion of SNAP costs from the federal government to individual states. The Trump administration says the change will reduce fraud and waste in the program, but food access advocates warn it could make it harder for families who rely on SNAP to get the assistance that they need. Joining us now are Nolan Downey, Senior Director of Policy at the Greater Chicago Food Depository, And Natalie Moorhead, a SNAP recipient and Inglewood resident. Thanks for joining us to you both. Nolan, break down this policy change for us, please. What is it that states are now being required to pay or could be required to pay?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, this is yet another consequence that flows from the federal reconciliation bill, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill that passed last summer. This bill contained historic, unprecedented cuts to the social safety net, programs like SNAP, programs like Medicaid. We already have confronted in the state thousands of people losing benefits because of some provisions in that bill. Cruel and ineffective work requirements, harsh restrictions for lawfully present humanitarian immigrants, and now states across the country are grappling with the next very significant change that was made to the program, which is a portion of SNAP benefits could be shifted for the first time ever to states from the federal government. SNAP has always been 100% federally funded. Now states across the country are beginning to have to grapple with what could be hundreds of millions, even billions in some states. If they don't pay those bills, they will lose the SNAP program. And so that is what we're facing in Illinois, the total loss of the program.
Right. And that shift is based on error rates and it's the percentage of errors that the state makes in either over or underpaying its recipients. And according to the list from the USDA Food and Nutrition Administration program, Illinois is in the top five. It's the fifth, actually, with an error rate of about 14.67%, which we'll come back to in a little bit. But Natalie, I want to get you in here. You are a single mom of three. You rely heavily on the SNAP program to take care of yourself and your family. How have cuts to SNAP and some of the changes to SNAP and the Big Beautiful Bill impacted you and your family?
It's been a tremendously scary and uncertain time in my family, as well as other families in my community that heavily rely on these benefits. And a lot of us are working parents. So it's not like we're just sitting at home waiting on these benefits or relying on them. It's been kind of uncertain. And with everything going on and the constant changes, it gets uncertain by the day. So the anxiety and fear grows daily.
Right. And you work part-time, correct?
Yes,
right.
I'm a medical assistant.
Okay.
Correct.
And of course, that was one of the, you mentioned, Nolan, of course, the work requirements. And then, of course, there's the added, you know, sort of, I guess, requirement that you also have to show that you're working a certain number of hours or volunteering in order to continue receiving your benefits as well.
Yeah, that has been kind of hectic because I have a disabled son. One of my children is disabled. And trying to maintain a schedule where I can provide money to pay my bills and be there for my children with these new requirements, it's making it almost impossible. And it's forcing parents like myself and other families to make these hard decisions on, are we going to work or are we going to lose our benefits? You know, what are we going to do, you know?
Nolan, the Department of Agriculture, as we mentioned, says that Illinois has a 13.3% overpayment error rate and a 1.33% underpayment error rate. What do those numbers mean? How are they calculated?
Yeah, I mean, in the simplest possible terms, you really nailed it. The payment error rate is very simply just a measure of whether people on SNAP were paid the right amount. Now, SNAP, like income-based programs, other income-based programs, there are a multitude of financial and non-financial factors that impact people's eligibility and the amount of benefits that they get. Any small discrepancy between any number of those factors could impact their benefit amount and thus create an error. Somebody picks up an extra shift at work and doesn't report the additional income. Somebody reports their rent and their utilities together instead of separately, like they're supposed to under program rules. There are a lot of things that folks could do that are overwhelmingly innocent, unintentional mistakes that nonetheless could create these errors. I think we need to push back forcefully on the federal narrative that these are a result of fraud. Fraud in the SNAP program is overwhelmingly low. 0.1% of households in Illinois, according to the last recent data that I saw, have been investigated, not found guilty of, but investigated for fraud. Fraud does not meaningfully exist in the program. And so any proposition that this is a program that is rife with fraud is just simply not true.
Natalie, what does it, you know, what does it mean to you? What do you hear? What does it feel like when you hear that, you know, all of these problems and this potential, you know, massive millions of dollars of payments that the state is going to have to make? What does that mean to you that it comes down to these numbers?
It's very disheartening for me, and it's discouraging as well because it leaves families like myself to figure out how we're going to survive, and we're working the best that we can, and we're doing the most that we can with this situation. Hearing that we're reduced to numbers, it's very, I want to say, kind of inhumane. It makes us feel less than, and it definitely takes away from us as people who receive these benefits. Hearing that we're reduced to a number, or we're categorized by mistakes that the system has made, you know, it makes me feel disheartened and very, very discomforted.
Mm-hmm. Nolan, how much could Illinois end up paying for SNAP, and when would that kick in?
Yeah, so in future years, we're now looking at October 2028 when this bill could become due. We're talking about up to $700 million. And that is money, again, that if we do not pay that, we lose the program entirely. And that is not an option. We're going to do everything that we can to reverse these unjust, unfair cuts at the federal level in their entirety. We want everything that was done in the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill reversed. But until that goal is achieved, the state needs to prepare now to absorb this financial cost, because if we don't do that, we lose the entire program. And again, that is just simply not an option.
And that $700 million, that is a portion of what it costs already, correct? That's not penalties or fines.
No, that's $700 million, which is about 15% of all the benefits that flow into the state. So that $700 million, we're paying that in order to preserve a $4 billion program that serves about 1.7 million people in the state. So critical program that, you know, this arrangement is unjust, but until we reverse it, we've got to prepare to preserve the program in the state.
Okay. All right, that's where we'll have to leave it. Nolan Downey and Natalie Moorhead, best of luck to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, we go inside a boxing club that's giving young athletes new opportunities. A boxing club on the city's west side is offering resources to young people in the community. Roy Flowers started the club 5 years ago in hopes of giving youth a free and supportive space. We visited Austin to see what it's all about.
Every Tuesday night, Coach Roy Flowers leads a free boxing program in the Austin community.
When I was a kid, I wish they had programs, you know, more positive programs so I could come.
Flowers founded the program in 2021, nearly two decades after being released from prison. His goal? To help kids and young adults have more opportunities than he had at their age.
I just wanted to be the mentor that I wish I had.
Here, Flowers says his team fosters deep relationships with the youth they coach between the ages of 5 and 21, including Josiah Owens.
Taught me so much about how to channel life, how to deal with my emotions, and completely like made my 360 my whole life basically.
One, two, one.
Owens has been a part of the program for 2 years.
It's okay to be angry, but you can't be angry every time. You got to be calm at some point, and they really taught me how to be calm.
Control yourself. Look at me.
Terrence Ross has been coaching the club for that same time. He says the relationship he's fostered with the kids keeps him coming back.
We like a family. I speak to the kids every day, you know, have fun with them. We get a nice, good relationship with the kids, you know. They love me and I love them.
One, two. It helped me gain confidence in who I am as a person.
They're like family here. They make you like want to keep doing it like over and over.
At one point, the gym had close to 300 participants. But in 2025, Flowers says the program faced significant funding cuts from the state, forcing them to pivot.
We were forced to reduce the program and make it smaller. Had to make the adjustment. I wanted to quit, but then I looked at some of the kids' faces, and I was like, I can't, you know, so I just kept on.
Despite the setback, Flowers is paying out of pocket with some donations to keep the program running. Though he says funding for the rest of the year is likely to be secured. He has ambitions to rent a larger space with his local church. Until the money is ready, they practice at a nearby gym, also in Austin. Local neighbor Shawnee Gross rents Out West Boxing to Flowers. The longtime resident believes in the positive impact the gym can have.
If people have a safe, healthy outlet where they can express themselves, Then they don't carry these things around inside.
Crystal Mendoza came across the gym while walking through her neighborhood. She says the free program drew her in.
Financially, people are struggling outside. The economically speaking, people are not doing well. So it's very important to people have like that kind of release or have like peace on their mind, discipline, and it's free.
You know, sometimes you get kids to come down with their head down, but when they come out of this program, their head be up high.
The program also includes access to youth employment opportunities. Flowers says funding for the next year has been secured through a state grant. Last month, Flowers moved the club to a new, larger location and says they're accepting donations. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Black Voices.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. And we leave you tonight with sights, but unfortunately no bites, from Taste of Chicago. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night. Favorite words.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.